All right, we are now in week four of an 18-week series. One of the real advantages that we have in Kerygma is that we don't have to rush. We can take time. I know a lot of our venues, 2 or 3 weeks is a long series, but we do have the luxury and the joy of being able to kind of get into some depth and stuff. So we're still on sort of the front end of this, dealing with some basic issues before we plunge in deeper. So again, big picture, the 18 weeks are on the relationship between science and faith. So we're going to be exploring both. We'll be going back and forth. We're going to be doing an awful lot of science in this series, but then in some weeks, we're going to be looking at the faith part. For example, tonight, we'll be definitely on the science side. After our initial sort of introduction overview, we spent 2 weeks, the last 2 weeks, sort of defining some basic things like, you know, what do we mean by faith in terms of the relationship with science? And also, you know, what is science? What is the scientific method? We looked at that last week. So the topic for tonight is this. There's this idea out there, you can see it at least in two Time magazines. You know, you get the God versus science. You know, we got evolutionary wars and that conflict language. There's a broad perception out in our culture and our society that there is tension, conflict, maybe even war. War is pretty aggressive language, but that language is used. But the root idea is that somehow or another, in our culture, we've gotten the idea that faith and science, or science and religion, interchangeable terms, are fundamentally incompatible. That we have to choose one or the other. I shared with some of you a few weeks back that working with teenagers for, you know, close to 50 years, this is an issue that came up like every year in confirmation. A perceived tension between what they're being taught the church versus what they were being taught to school. Now here's a recent publication that kind of captures it, the warfare between science and religion, the idea that wouldn't die, sort of indicating that this idea has been out there for a while and it is simply not going away. Here's another publication, Fact versus Fiction, Why Science and Religion Are Incompatible. By the way, from a New York Times best-selling author. Here's another, the idea of God as a failed hypothesis, you know, science language there. But the little subtitle is interesting, how science shows that God does not exist. Smart enough person not to use the word proof, but sort of hinting at that, shows. And yet another, of course, our favorite, Richard Dawkins, the most prolific of all these authors, Richard Dawkins, okay, from the year 2007, won a lot of awards, sold a lot of books. So we're going to begin tonight by reminding ourselves of a fundamental fact that is something that is frequently ignored. And I don't know if it's people just don't know it or simply unaware of it or choose to ignore it. But here it is. For many, a lot, within both the religious community as well as the scientific communities, there is no inherent conflict between science and faith, science and religion. So just going to explore that for a few minutes here. Many people of profound faith openly embrace science without in any way feeling that they have to compromise their faith to the least. Many Christian traditions, including the United Methodist and the world's largest Christian denomination, the Roman Catholic Church, view science and faith as legitimate tools for interpreting God's natural world. You can add the Episcopal Church to this, you can add the Lutheran Church to this, you can add the Presbyterian Church to this. I mean, this is not a fringe belief. Believing that they are not inherently incompatible, but the language is they're complementary, which means they're different, but they're not in conflict. Recent Catholic statements, including the 1996 encyclical by John Paul II, called Faith and Reason. If you look over here in this poster on the right, it says, faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises in the contemplation of truth. So very complementary language. Another statement from that is evolution is not inconsistent with the notion of creation. So just, you know, open embrace. Our Methodist tradition is even clearer in embracing science and faith unequivocally. We looked at this the first week, but I'm just going to lift up two slides here, just a brief piece of this. This is from our official doctrinal standards. We recognize science as a legitimate interpretation of God's natural world. We affirm the validity of the claims of science in describing the natural world. I mean, it cannot be more plain than that. No hemming, hawing, unequivocal, yes, science. Likewise, many scientists are also people of faith who practice their faith without feeling like they have to compromise their science in any way. Now, this is an openly acknowledged by the National Academy of Sciences. So, for example, on their website, you can look this up. They have a statement on religion and science. We looked at this the last week, but again, I'm just going to lift up a small piece of it. Religion and science answer different questions about the world. This is that complementary language. Whether there is a purpose to the universe or a purpose to human existence are not questions for science. Science is a way of knowing about the natural world. It is limited to explaining the natural world through natural causes. That's just the definition of science. Science can say nothing about the supernatural. Whether God exists or not is a question, is not a question science can answer. Now, some recent polling is interesting. According to a 2009 survey by the Natural Academy of Sciences of its own members, nearly half of all scientists say they believe in God, 44%. If you change the term God to deity or higher power, the number climbs actually to a majority, 51%. According to another study by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, this was conducted by the Pew Research, which is the premier polling group, nearly half of all scientists not only pray to God, but believe that God answers their prayers. According to the same study, only 1 in 6 scientists is actually an atheist. You can look that up on the website. If you look over there in the chart, the biggest singular group is nothing in particular. You know, if you add in odd agnostic, which is say don't know, that's roughly a third. You know, 17% atheist, but look, 16% mainline Protestant, 10% Catholic, 4% evangelical Protestant. The line between faith and science is not as sharply drawn as some would like us to think. So just trying to get that on the table. Now, Barbara's right. In principle, given the nature of science and the nature of religion as we've looked at and their historic relationship, in principle, there should be no conflict between science and religion, science and faith, which raises the question, just where did this idea come from? Because it sounds like it shouldn't exist, but clearly it does exist. So what are we dealing with here? I want to take us on just a little, about 5 minutes or so, a little historical sidebar so that we can understand where this actually arose from. The idea that there's an inherent conflict between science and religion is a, historically speaking, is a very recent development. It began in the late 19th century and really was only catching traction in the beginning of the 20th century. Its origins, it's widely known, there's no secret here, lie with two men and two books which became hugely influential. The idea of this was first introduced by a man called John William Draper, who was a chemist, in the year 1874. He wrote a book called History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. Let's look at that language. History of the Conflict. In 1896, Andrew Dixon White picked up Draper's ideas, repackaged them in his book, History of the, here's the shift in the language, of the warfare of science and theology in Christendom. Now, historians tell us it's from these two books that the idea that science and faith are incompatible were first introduced into our vocabulary and into our culture. It's where the language of conflict and war first emerged. Here's the opening sentence of Draper's work. He just puts it out there right up the front. The history of science, you know, science at this point has been around, what, over 2,000 years. The history of science is a narrative of the conflict between two contending powers. The expansive force of human intellect and the compressive force arising from traditionary faith. So these are being put out there as opposites. Human intellect, traditionary faith. Draper then introduces the idea of conflict as if it's been there always. It's, you know, like it's always been the case. When in fact, he is actually introducing an entirely new and novel concept. This idea and language are not found anywhere in the ancient world, not the Greek world, not the Roman world, not the Jewish world, not in the early Christian world. It's not found in the Middle Ages. It is not found in the Reformation. And in the modern world, it is not found until the end of the 19th century. So the book really does put out there a brand new novel idea. Now, what drove Draper's work and motivated him to introduce this entire new idea? Actually, this is a case where we actually know what's motivating him. The truth is that Draper puts forth his own personal ideology as if it were an established historical fact, which of course it is not. Now, philosophically, Draper buys into something that many of us may not be that familiar with. I did a little research myself. You know, he had bought into a philosopher's views, Auguste Comte, and the book was called The Introduction to, it's called Positive Philosophy. Part of Comte's views was that there are certain immutable laws that govern history. Immutable meaning they never change. There are certain laws that drive history without exception. Comte had published his theories in the 1840s. Draper was a disciple. He embraced these ideas. These laws are not empirical. They are not based on science. Rather, they are ideological and philosophical. That's what Comte is. He's a philosopher. Specifically, Draper embraced the idea, Comte's idea, of the three stages of history. That human history had evolved. And it's evolved through three stages of development, from the more primitive to the more advanced. The original human development was the religious stage, which he would say would be everything up to, say, the Middle Ages. And basically this, for him, is the era of just superstition. There's no real knowledge here at all, just superstition. Then during the Middle Ages, we have something developed called the metaphysical, which is logical rationalism, that you're using your brain. This is not science. This is more what you might call philosophy. And then finally, with the 1600s, we move into the positivistic, which, by the way, for him means empirical science. So here's where it crunches. For Comte and Draper, religion represents mere superstition, the lowest and most primitive form of human knowledge there is. Whereas empirical science represented the highest form of knowledge. Again, there's nothing scientific about this. There's nothing empirical about this. This is an ideology or a philosophy. Now, there's some other factors that are happening at the same time that give this book a lot more traction than it might otherwise have had. For example, Draper was violently anti-Catholic. He's from a Protestant background. By religion in this book, he does not mean Christianity. He actually means Roman Catholicism, which he hates. 4 years before Draper wrote the book, the first Vatican Council met, and it was a historic council that made a lot of decisions. One of the things that the council did is it critiqued what it called rationalism, but in the Catholic version, what was really being critiqued was modern science and reason as opposed to faith. This is also the first council that affirmed papal infallibility. For Draper, this was religion attacking science, when it really had to do with the Catholic Church. This was also a period, coincidentally, when science was beginning to be organized professionally. And we're beginning to have professional organizations form. The term scientist is coined and is being used the first time. So there's a certain amount of professional, you know, pride here. And here's a book that told these newly minted scientists that they are the highest form of human endeavor. Because of that, historians say, this led many within the science community to view Draper's book favorably, even if they viewed it uncritically. Now, 22 years later, Andrew Dixon White embraces Draper's ideas, and he sort of recasts them in his version, in his book. He elevates the language of conflict to the language of war. White's thesis is simply this, and just listen to the language. Throughout all modern history, now he's limiting it to modern history, but throughout all modern history, interference with science and the supposed interest of religion has resulted in the direst evils, both to religion and to science, and invariably so. This is that Comte philosophy. And on the other hand, all untrammeled, all free scientific investigation, no matter how dangerous to religion some of the stages may have seemed to be at the time, has, here it is again, invariably resulted in the highest good for religion and science. Now, White's primary source for his book is Draper's work. He basically takes Draper's work and reframes it and puts some of his own material in. Now, if you step outside this and you get modern historians to look at this, and say a person like Lawrence P. Rincipe from John Hopkins University, who has a really good science religion series in the great courses, he says, quote, that both books are totally unreliable and are laughable. Both books are widely seen today as the epitome of being unscientific and unhistorical, just running in a laundry list of your personal prejudices under the flag of science. But here's the problem. Once their ideas are out there, as we know from our own day and time, fake news or whatever, once you put it out there, it's got traction of its own and a life of its own. These works created and reinforced myths, created and reinforced myths that still stand to this day. Give you just a couple examples. Here's one. The belief that before Christopher Columbus, people thought the world was flat. Well, that's just not true. As early as 5th century BC, the Greeks had figured out the world was round. They even calculated the circumference of the earth, the diameter, and got pretty darn close. Throughout history, people knew the world was round. You know, maybe, you know, there's a few bubbas out there who thought it was flat, just like today. But where do we get the idea that people used to think that? Well, that idea was introduced in these books without any historic background or underwriting. According to some surveys, the idea that we used to think the world was flat is still taught in 80% of school teachers today. I find that surprising, but that's a statistic that's out there. Here's another example, probably the biggest one, is the warfare thesis itself. Both men presented an idea no one had ever heard of as history, as though it were something that had always been true, maybe going back to Aristotle, who knows. In their language, the conflict is invariably and always been there. Soon, many uncritically accepted their conflict thesis and believed that it had always been true, just as they said, because they said it. Now, the claim that science and faith are in conflict or war with each other continues to be fed today. And what we're going to be looking at today in the next few weeks, it's fed from both sides. It's fed from the science side, and it's fed by some within the science side and some within the faith community. So, but tonight we're concerned with the faith side. Next week we'll start a multiple week exploration of the faith side, because we want to retrace the story of what the relationship was and how that changes. But for tonight, let's just take a look at how this has developed in the 20th century, early 21st century, within the scientific community, by people who are self-labeled as people of science or maybe scientists. Now, from the science side, we can see two, probably three, but at least two things happening in the publications of books like this, Fact Versus Fiction. You start looking, reading the book, figure out what's going on here. Well, there's a couple of things going on. The first is there tends to be an overreaching of the claims for what science can legitimately do. In other words, some people are putting books out saying that science can do stuff that science can't do. For example, that science can prove that God didn't exist. Well, if you know anything about science, you know that's not true. Couldn't be true by the definition of science. Second is the denial of this, and this goes further, and this is the one we'll sort of end with tonight, is the denial of the validity of religion as a source of human knowledge at all. Now, first, overreaching. Overreaching by some within the science community is a well-known fact even within the scientific community, and many people of science critique other people within the science community for doing this. Here's the truth. People of science can make statements and claims that are not scientific in nature, but which are put forward as science. Look at Steger's book there. Science shows that God does not exist. That's a typical example. Such as the claim that there's no God, or that all religion is irrational, without a different book, by definition. I want to give you one example that we can kind of play with. This is a quotation from Steven Weinberg. It was put out in New Scientist, which is the premier science magazine in Great Britain. And this was back in 2006. This is what he said. The world, by the way, his audience is other scientists. The New Scientist is basically read by scientists and people who love science. That's his audience. The world needs to wake up from the long nightmare of religion. Anything we scientists, sort of been bunching them all together, anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done. And this may be our greatest contribution to civilization. As though we scientists can just kill off religion, that is a great contribution to civilization. Now, think for a second. There's nothing remotely scientific in these views. There's nothing empirical. There's nothing that uses the scientific method. His comments are ideological, not scientific. Weinberg is simply expressing his personal anti-religious prejudices. Since he is a scientist by profession, this can be seen as an example of a conflict between science and religion. And it is clear that this is his intent when he starts addressing scientists. Someone has come on and has got your microphone on, because if you could check that, we're getting a lot of background noise from one source. So appreciate your help. Now, again, as if he were speaking for all people of science, which of course he is not. But just because a scientist says something, once again, does not make it science and does not mean it's scientific. This is well known from within the scientific community. So how about we get some scientific voices to weigh in on this issue? Here's Richard Feynman. Many of you know him. Noted theoretical physicist in the area of quantum mechanics. And I just love the way he phrases this. He just gives us an important reminder. And this is simply just to, you know, for perspective. Outside of their field, scientists are just as dumb as the next guy. And that's just good to know, you know. You got a physicist pontificating on geology. Well, that's not his field, nor is religion. Add to this that people of science are just as prone to personal bigotry bias and prejudice, as is the next person. And I would say, as is a person of faith. They're not exempt from this. This is further complicated when people of science make non-scientific claims in the name of science. Again, this is something that even scientists acknowledge and critique. As in when they claim there is no God, as when they claim religion is delusion. Again, non-scientific claims made by scientists, therefore some people think maybe this is science. Here's Richard Darling, quantum physicist. Here's three of his books. He's written about 30. Again, top-notch scientist. As a society, we have made the mistake that because science can answer some questions very well, it might eventually be able to answer all questions. Scientists need to be quite modest in their claims. But recently, a number of them, and we could name names but won't, have been growing more ambitious. The result has been a number of grandiose claims that can neither be scientifically justified or fulfilled. Good balancing work. Now, with this as a background, we're ready to explore the real issue that's at the heart of most of the conflict that we deal with today. This is something that has come out of science. It is frequently put forward as science, something that is advocated by some within the scientific community, roundly rejected by many other scientists, and it's something referred to as naturalism. So with the rest of our time tonight, I want to look at this because this is the big, this is the elephant in the room. This is the big issue. Now, here's one of the complicating factors. Naturalism can refer to two things that are radically different, but they go by the same name. That's always confusing. The first simply has to do with the way science operates. It is known as, the full name is methodological naturalism. It's a mouthful. But all it means, and this is the original meaning of naturalism, this is when we say science proper, we're talking about methodological naturalism. Simply states that the arena of scientific endeavor, its methodology, is limited to the natural order, the stuff of nature. Science is by definition, by methodological naturalism, by definition, limited to the natural world, not anything else. Here's Aaron McMullen, internationally respected philosopher of science, University of Notre Dame. Methodological naturalism does not restrict our study of nature. It just lays down which sort of study qualifies as scientific. If someone wants to pursue another approach to nature, and there are many such others, the methodological naturalist has no reason to object. Scientists simply have to proceed in this way. But the methodology of natural science does not exclude the claim that a particular event or type of event can be explained by invoking God's creative action. It does not rule that out. It is just that such claims are not relevant for scientific inquiry. They are faith claims, not science claims. Here's Eugene Scott, Executive Director for the Center of Science Education. Science neither denies or opposes the supernatural. It ignores the supernatural. It does, though, for methodological reasons. Even in the scientific community, it is well known that there is no inherent conflict between faith and naturalism as a methodology, which is to say, the philosophical underpinnings of science. The problem is that naturalism has, in more recent years, taken on a second meaning. And it is this second meaning that dominates the discussion today. Here's a great book by Alvin Plantinga, Where the Conflict Really Lies. He really gets into this, Science, Religion, Naturalism. The second meaning is known as ontological naturalism, not methodological, ontological. Whereas methodological naturalism has to do with the limits of science, that science is restricted to the empirical or to the natural realm or to nature. Ontological naturalism goes a lot further. Ontological naturalism holds that the empirical or the natural realm is all that exists. And that empirical or natural data is all that counts, which is, of course, an entirely different claim. For ontological naturalism, the empirical is all there is. It is all that exists. Questions that cannot be resolved by empirical science are said to be meaningless, irrational, or delusional. This is one of the essential arguments in all of Richard Dawkins' books. This is the form of naturalism that we encounter most often today by those claiming science and faith are incompatible. Because by definition, they're defining naturalism ontologically, therefore by definition, if you can't measure it, quantify it, then it simply is not there. Ontological naturalism, let's just put it on the table, is atheistic by definition. There's another great book, Science Blind Spot, The Unseen Religion. Some think naturalism and atheism are inherently part of the scientific worldview. They are not. Any good scientist can tell you that. Ontological naturalism is not science. It is ideology, or as this book indicates, it's actually a form of religion. It is an atheistic form of religion. It gives answers to religious questions and makes claims that are religious in nature, such as the claim there is no God. Now, there's nothing empirical about that statement. That is a philosophical, statement. That's a religious statement, not scientific. What this means that's relevant for our discussion is that much of the perceived conflict between modern science and faith has absolutely nothing to do with science. Rather, it reflects an ideology known as naturalism. In other words, the conflict from the science side, from those who do this, is self-generated and self-maintained by people who have a vested interest in putting forth their own personal views under the flag of science. The tragedy is that they have done this in an area in which there is no innate conflict. So it is an artificial, false, manufactured conflict. This is something that is openly acknowledged within the scientific community. Freeman Dyson, Dyson Fears, you may know him. Theoretical physicist, mathematician, his pedigree is just beyond repute. Here's what he has to say. Science and religion are two windows that people look through, trying to understand the big universe out there, trying to understand why we are here. These two windows give different views, but they look out at the same universe. Both views are one-sided. Neither is complete. Both leave out essential features of the real world. Both are worthy of respect. Trouble arises when either science or religion claims universal jurisdiction. And I'll just say sort of parenthetically that this is really the thesis of this entire series. Trouble arises when either science or religion claims universal jurisdiction. When either religious or scientific dogma, because both exist, claims to be infallible. Religious creationists and scientific materialists, naturalists, are equally dogmatic and equally insensitive. By their arrogance, they bring both science and religion into disrepute. The media also exaggerate their numbers and importance. The media rarely mention the fact that we covered earlier that the great majority of religious people belong to moderate denominations that treat science with respect, or the fact that the great majority of scientists treat religion with respect. so long as religion does not claim jurisdiction over scientific questions. Our Book of Discipline says the same thing about science, so long as science does not claim jurisdiction over religious questions. So very much balanced. Now, it's clear that a conflict can emerge from the science side if people do any of three things. They can deny the reality of anything that is not empirical, something known as ontological naturalism, which we know is not science, or they can put forth their personal and ideological views as science. That's not science. Or by making non-scientific claims, saying things like belief in God is a delusion. That's not science. The broad consensus within the scientific community, and it's a very broad consensus, is that none of these things is science or scientific, but this is only half the story. And that's where we're going to be moving next in the next few weeks. It's only half the story of the conflict between science and faith. People of faith can also make claims that infringe on the domain of science. And the examples are legion. It is to this that we're going to turn next week as we're going to explore what has been the historic relationship between science and faith from the beginning, how and when did it change, and how from the faith side did we start having the idea that from a faith perspective, you cannot embrace science or you cannot embrace parts of science. So we will get to that next week.